Welcome to Behind the Headlines from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, a weekly roundup of local news heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, protests in the wake of the release of body cam footage from a fatal police shooting, criticism of Operation Rio Grande from a visiting homelessness researcher, an attempt in Congress to limit the power of the president to declare national monuments, and more. And joining me to discuss these stories, Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canna. Matt, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Government reporter Matt Piper, great to have you here as well, Matt. Welcome.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Columnist Robert Gerke, thanks for being here as well.
Good morning.
And on the phone today, Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Welcome, Tommy, and good morning.
Hey, good morning.
And we ask that you join us for this conversation as well. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com or call us up at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And we're going to start with Thomas Burr in Washington today. Tommy, you reported on a bill that aims to essentially gut the Antiquities Act. It's cleared a first hurdle. What would this legislation do, and who's behind it?
Yeah, this has been a long-time Republican idea to get rid of the power the president has to name monuments unilaterally. Currently, a president can pretty much do what he wants when it comes to this. If he finds some area of federal land that he wants to make a national monument, he or she could do that. So Rob Bishop's bill, which passed the House Natural Resources Committee this week without a hearing for the record, would essentially give limit, very, very severely limit, president's power to do that. It would add things like if you want to create a monument, essentially, you'd have to have the local county officials say so, the legislature of the state where it's going to be, and the governor's approval to do so.
This is, yeah, and if the monuments were larger than 10,000 acres, a president could still unilaterally declare monuments as long as they were smaller than 640 acres. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty small. I mean, it's literally, a little, 640 acres is can be large to some people, but if you're looking at most monuments that have been created, including four or five now national parks in Utah,
right,
that were created much larger than that. So it does pretty much give the power, take the power away from the president to do that.
The drive behind this bill, according to its sponsor, Representative Rob Bishop, is to give more power to local stakeholders in monument declarations. I mean, that's what you just said, essentially, that you have to have the buy-in from counties, legislatures, governors of a state before you can do anything.
Yeah, but I think if you you talk to the environmentalists, the conservationists, and look at this, they're saying this pretty much would hamstring any ever monument declaration, mainly because try to get all that buy-in from everyone, for everyone to agree, would never happen. And so, therefore, you never maybe see a national monument ever created again.
How did Democrats respond? You quoted the top Democrat on this committee, for example.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Raul Grijalva of Arizona said this would destroy the Antiquities Act, which is the 1906 law that that has been used by every president since Teddy Roosevelt to name monuments. There'd be no way to name a monument, and he said it just totally guts the law. So this is what we expect to happen. The bill went to the House floor and will probably get voted on at some point in the next month or so. The issue, though, becomes the Senate, which is probably not going to take up the legislation. If they do so, it's probably not going to pass.
In this same committee, Tommy, there was an effort by Democrats to shed some light on the review process that was ordered by the president and took place under Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. They wanted to kind of peer behind the curtain to see how the recommendations that came out of that review process were devised, I guess. How did that happen? How did that happen? But what happened to that initiative, that push for greater transparency?
Sure, this was actually kind of interesting. So the Democrats on the House Natural Resources Committee introduced a resolution. It was a little complicated, but it's called a privilege revolution. So the resolution, so that essentially they had to hold a hearing on it, or it would go on the House floor and demand a vote. And so the committee took it up. The resolution was essentially, we just want to know what's happening in this national monument review process. So why, give us the documents. Who did you meet with? Who did you talk to? What was the feedback that you actually got? And it was interesting. I've never seen this as a reporter covering Washington more than 12 years now. They actually passed the bill, essentially, passed the resolution, but unfavorably. So there's no chance it will ever be taken up by the House. It was essentially to kill the resolution so the Democrats didn't get to what they wanted. But again, it was literally just a resolution to say, hey, show us what you have.
Show us your sort of the documents behind this. I'm going to send a quick reminder to listeners to join us with your questions and comments about the stories that we're covering today. Call us at 801-355-8255, or you can comment at sltrib.com. And just quickly, 640 acres, that's the size that a president would be able to declare under Rob Bishop's proposal, a monument without having to go through any hoops. For people looking at landscape scale or ecosystem scale conservation, conservationists that you quote, they're wouldn't that kind of make the declaration pointless, or is there a way that a president could declare a whole bunch of 640-acre monuments in quick succession, Tommy, under this proposal? Kind of an odd idea.
Yes. They actually thought about that when they came to the bill. So it's actually, if you look at it, you can't name one within 50 miles of another. So essentially, you could do a pocket of 640 acres and a pocket of 640 acres over here, but they have to be 50 miles away from each other. Also, the president would have the power to name a national monument in a, quote, emergency, but that declaration would expire within a year. So if there was some reason to do something, Congress would have to step in to preserve it more than a year. But, yeah, 640 acres, and you can't do it within 50 miles of another national monument. So they thought of that.
Well, it's a year in emergencies. I'm thinking about the management plan that's supposed to be being devised for Bears Ears National Monument right now. I want to get thoughts from Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke on this story. And, Tommy, there are other aspects of this that I'll circle back to you on in just a moment.
Sure.
But Gerke, a move to drastically reimagine the Antiquities Act, which Representative Bishop says has been misused. This isn't unsurprising given the state's stance on federal public lands and conservation in general.
Yeah, I mean, Rob Bishop's been trying to get rid of the Antiquities Act for many years now, and this Bears Ears thing was sort of the breaking point, I guess. Keep in mind, 640 acres is basically one square mile, so you're talking an area probably roughly half the size of the University of Utah campus. And so we're talking about very small areas, and within a 50-mile radius, you've got all of this area in southern Utah that has been protected, as Tommy mentioned, through the Antiquities Act for the five national parks. You got Cedar Breaks National, and now Bears Ears, Grand Staircase, all of these monuments that are being protected, this land that's been protected under the Antiquities Act. And this would make that just impossible in the future. But Congress has the right to do this. They gave the president the authority to use the Antiquities Act. They can take it away. They can also, if they don't like the monuments, they have the power. They've always had the power to rescind monuments, redesignate areas that they think need to be changed. They just haven't had the political will or courage to do it. And so this is sort of short-circuiting that. And I don't even know that the 640 acres is necessarily the bigger problem in this, as it is, when you start talking about having to have buy-in from the local governments, which, yes, you want to consult with the local governments, but at the end of the day, this is federal land. This land belongs to everybody, whether they're in Utah, whether they're in San Juan County, whether they're in, whatever community they're in. It belongs to everybody. And so, you want to consult with them, you want to get buy-in, but it's hard to imagine a scenario in which Utah leaders or county leaders in southern Utah are going to buy into any monument designation. So it really hampers the process for designating these national monuments. Now, people like Rob Bishop would probably think that's exactly right. That's exactly what we want to do. And this power has been abused and we're going to take it away now.
Well, and one last part of this that is kind of interesting on the same line of reasoning there. Actually, it's a different part of the bill, which is that it would explicitly give the president power to shrink national monuments. And Kind of counterintuitively, maybe, Democrats and conservationists kind of see that as a silver lining. I'm going to throw this back to Thomas Burr. Why would that be something they see as a silver lining in this?
Yeah, you're right. Exactly right on that one. Because right now they think that the president has the power to do so already. So putting it into a bill to try to make it a law kind of assumes that the president doesn't have the power to do so right now. Presidents have in the past changed monuments from their predecessors, trimming them a little bit, changing them over here, over there. But putting into a law kind of says, well, maybe that wasn't necessarily already approved.
Okay. Yeah,
and the shrinkage of the past monuments wasn't really challenged in court. So the thinking being, if President Trump tries to shrink Bear's Ears or shrink Grand Staircase, those will be challenged in court. And the admission, essentially, in putting it in the bill that it's unclear at the very least that the president has the authority to do that strengthens the case when they go to court.
Okay. Meanwhile, Congress itself is trying to, the House is trying to get this bill out of committee. It's out of committee, and now it moves on to the full House. Does it have the support there it needs to pass, Tommy? And how about in the Senate?
If it does get taken up by the House, I mean, there's only, 26 legislative days left in the year. There's not much. Even though it's mid-October, they don't have much time left. But it's one of those bills that has, good Republican support, so House Speaker Paul Ryan could take it up. When it gets to the Senate has a lot of things on its agenda, and this is not one that I think that is going to rise to the top. You also think that Republicans hold 52 seats in the Senate, but some of those folks are not inclined to vote for it. I take a Susan Collins from Maine, for example, is not going to be one who probably supports limiting the Antiquities Act.
Okay, Robert Gricke.
Tommy's right. I think the Senate is unlikely to take it up. All you're going to need is one Democrat necessarily to file, to try to file a filibuster motion, basically, and they need 60 votes on it. And I don't think Mitch McConnell's going to put a lot of political capital behind getting this bill through the Senate. So it becomes a lot more difficult to get it through there. And as Tommy mentioned, the House is running out of time. And I think this kind of goes back to another issue that since we're talking about Rob Bishop and monuments, he's had the Public Lands Initiative that he's been working on for years now, and he's still not able to get that through. And if he doesn't like the way monuments are being designated in the past, then there's got to be a way for him. He's the chairman of the House Resources Committee. He's now a fairly senior member of the House caucus. There's got to be a way for him to get the Public Lands Initiative passed, but he's just not able to get it across the line.
All right. Well, find further details on this and all the rest of the stories that we're covering today at sltrib.com. We need to head to a break, but first I want to thank Thomas Burr, Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief, for joining us. Tommy, I know you've got other places to be, but thanks once again for being here.
Thank you.
When we come back, the release of body cam footage and the fatal police shooting of a black man leads to protests. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in a moment.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members, and support for science reporting on Utah Public Radio comes from the Utah State University Ecology Center, providing training opportunities for today's science communicators, one story at a time.
This week in This American Life, Alex is stranded on an island. No cell phone, no food, his boat's out of gas. And he's just across the water from New York City. You can see planes landing.
You can see skyscrapers, and on the other side, you can die looking at them, And also, I got a little mad at the city of New York. I could understand if they had just one payphone there.
This week.
Join us tomorrow morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Cache Valley Visitors Bureau, showcasing outdoor access to the National Forest for hiking, fishing, and camping. Information on trails, campsites, and more is available online at explorelogan.com.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, government reporter Matt Piper, and columnist Robert Gricke. It's our Friday local news wrap-up, and we welcome your questions and comments at sltrib.com, or you can call us up at 801-355-8255. to Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham now. And Matt, it has been 9 days since the release of body cam footage in the shooting death of Patrick Harmon. Harmon was a black man who was stopped for crossing traffic on his bicycle at night without a light. He was found to have warrants. Then he tried to flee, and he was shot by police. The release of this body cam footage came after a ruling by Salt Lake County District Attorney that the shooting was legally justified. But members of the local chapter of Black Lives Matter and other local protesters say the footage shows that the shooting wasn't justified, and they've been demanding action and justice. And what kind of action are they asking for, Matt Canham?
They want District Attorney Sim Gill fired. They also want the officer involved in this, Clinton Fox, to be charged with murder. They think this video shows the police officer shooting Patrick Harmon in the back as he flees. Sim Gill argues that if you slow the video down, Mr. Harmon is turning towards the officers with a knife, and so therefore the officer had a reasonable fear for his life and the life of his fellow officers, so that the shooting was justified.
You mentioned Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill. Just kind of a quick question on the request for his firing. He's an elected official. Who fires a district attorney?
Nobody. Essentially, they want him removed from office. So this could be two ways. He could either resign or he could lose the next election. But it's a sign that they do not trust him.
Okay.
And the actions he took in this case.
Meanwhile, Gill has asked the FBI to investigate this, to look at the shooting itself and at his ruling that it was justified. Is that correct?
Yes. Sim Gill is trying to beat back public pressure that he isn't fair in these cases. And he's doing that in two ways. First is he's asked for an FBI review. And these reviews are pretty open-ended. It's not like we're going to know when or how this concludes. Unless the FBI wants to tell us, and that is pretty hit and miss with the Federal Bureau of Investigation of whether they'll say a word about this going forward. The second thing he's done, and our colleague Paul Raleigh wrote about this in a column, is that he has Friday open hours, and he is saying that anyone who has a problem with his ruling on this should call his office, schedule one of those appointments, and come and talk to him face-to-face about it, and he'll talk to them.
You know, you mentioned Gill saying that the video, as it slowed down, shows Patrick Harmon turning and facing officers. The officer who fired the shots here, he said he was essentially more frightened than he's ever been when he was in this situation. Is that correct, Matt?
Yes, he did. This is an officer who has been in the military as well as on the streets, and he said that in all of his years, this was the most scared he has been in a situation. You know, the hard part with watching body camera footage is that you don't feel the emotion that the people in that scene feel. Mm-hmm. You get to see it. It's a little bit distant, but it's night. There's people running around. It's hard to get in someone's head. And that's part of what Sim Gill has said. When you're trying to justify or you're trying to decide whether a shooting is justified or not, it's does that officer reasonably fear for his life or the life of fellow people? And how do you get into someone's head about whether they're afraid or not?
A second officer on the scene deployed a taser. And maybe we can just veer over to Robert Gerke for a moment, Salt Lake Tribune columnist. I know you're not an expert on every topic in the world, but as a columnist, we're asking you to be. The Salt Lake City Police were lauded recently for de-escalation training. Is some of that about reaching for a taser instead of for a gun?
Well, I think that's a good point because I kind of feel like, you know, they've gotten a lot of praise for this de-escalation training, but now we've seen yet another incident where the de-escalation didn't seem to work. And I'm speaking, of course, of the, you know, there was the infamous University of Utah nurse who was dragged off in handcuffs, where the de-escalation training that they went through didn't work. And now we've got another incident with the shooting of Patrick Harmon. Watching the video, it's hard to watch for one thing, but it's also hard to see exactly what's going on there. And as Matt mentioned, it's hard to get in their heads. But I hate to second guess the police officers who were there. I mean, should he have reached for a taser versus his gun? These are split second decisions. It's hard to say. Ideally, yes. I mean, if he had pulled out his taser, then Patrick Harmon might still be alive today. But, you know, there's also a possibility that if he had reached for his taser instead of a gun, then Patrick Harmon maybe turned with a gun instead of a knife and the police officer's not alive. So these are split-second decisions. It's hard to second-guess, and that's why Sim Gill finds himself in a pretty tough situation on these, because he gets beat up from the police union when he you know, for example, in the University of Utah nurse case, the police union's coming after him as being anti-cop in that one. And so he finds himself in a tough situation. I think asking for the FBI review, you know, get a second set of eyes, professionals, to look at this and pass judgment on it. But, yeah, I mean— I think, going back to your question, though, I think the de-escalation training is critical. And if it's not working, we need to ask why it's not working, why it's not being effectively implemented. And the one last thing, I think, the reason I think that a lot of people are upset about this, more even maybe as much as the fact that it ended in a shooting, is that I think there's this sense that there's this double standard for black people versus white people. I mean, if Matt or I were riding our bikes at night and, you know, without a taillight, I'm not sure that we would necessarily have been stopped by a police officer. And that's the I think that's the sentiment that is that people are expressing about the, you know, is justice really colorblind in situations like this?
Yeah. All right. You know, that you talk about that de-escalation training and split second decisions having these devastating consequences. And I'm wondering if there isn't, I mean, maybe this speaks to injustice from a racial standpoint as well. Is there something that can't be trained away that leads people in situations that scare them to sometimes make a decision that that maybe they wouldn't make otherwise? What's to be done about that, Robert? How do we solve this problem?
I think that's an excellent question. And I think ideally the training starts to get at those issues, but you're probably right, and I think there have been studies that show that you can't completely get rid of those sensibilities, I guess, or, you know, when it comes to race.
I've talked to police officers about this, and they can't stand this conversation because it implies that they're racist, and that they think that, you know, you see a handful of instances that are split-second decisions, and it's easy to second-guess. What you don't see is every other interaction they have. Now, that's their point of view.
Right.
I mean, as Robert said, there's a lot of studies that talk about inherent bias, and there are stats even in Utah where whether it's minority kids in school who are disciplined more than white kids, or it's the number of police interactions— they are black people get more stop more than white people, though.
Well, and you might think that inherent bias might be exhibited more in split second decision making than in other instances. I don't know about that.
I don't know either. Yep. But I mean, I think the hard part is saying something's legally justified doesn't mean it was the right decision. Mm-hmm. It means it was one that will not lead to criminal charges, and that's where we are in this case.
Again, we want to hear your thoughts on this conversation. 801-355-8255 is the number to call. Matt, Patrick Harmon's relatives came from far away, from St. Louis, to participate in a rally. And I know that his niece and sister made that trip. What did his relatives have to say about his killing?
They're obviously heartbroken by the situation. Patrick Harmon was not living the life that his family probably would have wanted him to. He was his last known address was at the Road home. He had some charges against him that the police were trying to arrest him for that evening. But they didn't feel that the police gave him a reasonable chance. They don't feel that it's fair. They didn't like the way that this information was rolled out. They're upset. And they were part of the protest that we saw here at the police headquarters in downtown Salt Lake City, where you mentioned that the Black Lives Matter local chapter organized. There was about 150 people there who were upset. I've been to a couple of these rallies over the last few years, and we've had a lot of these rallies because we've seen a number of people who were shot and killed by police officers in a variety of different instances. And these people think that there's a problem with the police department. One thing I'll point out that's different between the Salt Lake Police and many of Utah's other police departments is they meet monthly with many of those same activists who were at that rally to talk about these issues. They have tried to build more trust within that activist community and the law enforcement. This is organized through Chief Brown, as well as people like Lex Scott, who was one of the protest organizers. We've written a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Those relationships obviously are more tense in the last week than they have been when we had a decent spell of time without any police shootings in Salt Lake City.
Right. One thing that that police reform groups and some of these protesters want to see happen is the release of body cam footage more quickly. To see, have it released in 24 or 48 hours, and then also to give a civilian review board the power to indict them. Robert, I'll go to you for an opinion on this. What do you think of those proposals?
Those are tough questions because I've thought a lot about the body cam issue, the body cam footage issue, and these are public records ultimately. And in the past, the district attorney's office has said that they don't want a tainted investigation. The people who are witnesses to the investigation might watch the body cam footage and change what they said they saw. So it's complicated. I'm generally speaking in favor of getting more information out quickly as opposed to, withholding it. But there are circumstances, particularly when you have a sort of a high profile and a sort of a volatile situation created by a shooting, and where you might want to hold it back a little bit. So I can kind of see both sides on that one. I think the civilian review board. The more involvement, like Matt mentioned, when you get citizenry involved in policing the police, I think that's entirely beneficial. I think. And it gives a outlet and a voice to some of the concerns that otherwise might not get the same sort of attention that they deserve. So I think that makes a lot of sense.
Hmm. Matt Canham, Mayor Jackie Biskupski issued a statement about this shooting and the response after the release of this footage. What did she have to say?
She tried to kind of thread the needle between supporting the police officers who work for the city, as well as having some sympathy for the protesters who are worried about what happened in this case. She wants to foster more dialogue. She wants to look at ways, policy that could help continue to reduce these kind of instances, which though she didn't add a lot of specifics on that front. Generally, she wanted to say that she heard people who were angry. She said that she wants police officers to be able to speak up, particularly when they're afraid in a situation, which is a totally normal human reaction.
Sure.
To some of these instances. But they also want those – she told the protesters that they should keep the pressure up as well. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting kind of threading the needle that probably what she's hoping for is some more sit-down conversations between these groups. Mm-hmm. And an ongoing conversation about how we police, particularly the minorities in our community.
And again, we talked about the FBI investigation that Sim Gill has requested of the incident and of his decision that it was justified. And we don't know how long that's going to take necessarily. But do we know in the meantime what's the status of the officer who fired the shots that ended up killing Harmon in this case?
So he's on the job, but a modified duty is what they call it. So that means he's not doing the exact same day-to-day activities as he was before the shooting. But I don't know what that actually means. But he is still on the job.
Okay. We're up against another break here, and we will turn to more from this past week's news when we come back, including a critical take on Operation Rio Grande. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
America is littered with abandoned movie theaters.
I actually photographed my 99th closed theater. And I get emails from people saying, my grandmother told me she used to go here with my grandfather.
A new generation rediscovers the pleasure palaces of the past. Sometimes you do just have to be there. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX.
Join us Sunday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Tristan Harris once had a successful career in Silicon Valley trying to manipulate your attention. And then he became disenchanted.
And so you started to see technology not as a vehicle for improving people's lives, but really as a means to persuade people to do things.
I'm Guy Raz. Ideas about manipulation? That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us Sunday afternoon at 2 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Piper, Matt Canham, and Robert Gerke. You can join us by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. We have yet to hear from government reporter Matt Piper. And Matt, thank you for your patience. Before the break, we were talking about the shooting death of Patrick Harmon. Harmon's last address was the Road Home Shelter, as Matt Canham mentioned. The area around the shelter is ground zero for Operation Rio Grande, an initiative to tackle crime in the area, especially drug dealing, and as part of a phased approach. It's to help homeless people get counseling, housing, employment even. This week, a homelessness researcher was in Utah for a conference, and he offered some pretty strong criticism of Operation Rio Grande. Matt Piper, who are we talking about, and what did he say?
His name is Ian DeJong. He is a nationally renowned homelessness expert, and I suppose you could probably say that about a lot of people.
Sure.
But in Ian's case, he is one that who is particularly relevant to Utah in that Utah is one of many communities across the country and even internationally that use his assessments to sort of triage homeless service seekers. So when you come to the front door, you fill out kind of his survey with a caseworker, and it directs you to the services that you're going to receive. He's playing a role in an effort by a nonprofit board, Shelter the Homeless, to create three new homeless shelters that we've heard a lot about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just all around, he is acknowledged as one of the leading experts in the field of homeless resource centers.
And so when he's, you know, making criticism like this, the point is that it's not sort of armchair quarterbacking or whatever you want to call it. It's someone who thinks about this topic a lot.
Right. And so, you know, I think what was perhaps newsworthy, and some would argue maybe that it wasn't, but what I felt was newsworthy about Ian coming in and sitting in on this panel discussion that included the lieutenant governor, the House Speaker, Salt Lake City's mayor, longtime homelessness advocate Pamela Atkinson, is that Ian is beholden to nobody. Ian has no. It doesn't matter who holds the strings or who controls the funding. Ian can kind of speak his mind with no repercussions.
Which he did.
And he did. And so we had not heard a whole lot publicly from service providers about Operation Rio Grande, other than something needed to happen, which I think was agreed upon by everybody. Anybody who had seen that area knew that something needed to happen. And that, you know, they would sort of do their best. And Ian went a step further and said, or I suppose he had a pretty strong opinion that Operation Rio Grande focusing on law enforcement is exactly the wrong way to deal with a problem as entrenched and as drug addiction.
And that's echoing something that the ACLU of Utah has said during this whole operation, the rollout of this operation, which this is a law and order action as opposed to what Ian DeJong called a people agenda, which he was tweeting all of this out, right? I mean, he was at the conference in question. He was here for a state homelessness summit, and he was actually invited by the state. His criticism came out in a series of tweets. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. He was sort of live tweeting that the panelists were privileged white people who could not understand the problem, and that legislators are naive to some of the intricacies of homeless service seekers. And I think, you know, it's worth noting that Ian, a big part of Ian's principles is to reduce barriers to services, to have as few barriers, as few requirements and rules. And so I think the idea of a drug court, of putting people in jail and then giving them the option to receive treatment through a drug court, where their charges could eventually be dropped, that to him sounds like rules and requirements that he doesn't believe, I think, are proven to change adult behavior. And so that's just a philosophy. It's very different from the philosophy of another homelessness expert who Salt Lake City has heard from in the recent past. But Robert Marbot,
yeah,
who came here with an invitation from the Pioneer Park Coalition, a couple times over the last couple years, who favors kind of a tough love approach where you'd have this campus and people kind of prove their willingness and readiness to receive homeless services and take advantage of them.
Matt, you got a response to DeJong's criticism during this conference from one person involved in Operation Rio Grande, sort of behind it, I guess. Jonathan Hardy, he's the director of Housing and Community Development, of the Housing and Community Development Division of the Department of Workforce Services. He's a fan of DeJong, actually, we should say. But what did he have to say about this criticism?
I mean, he thought DeJong is somebody who doesn't understand this as intimately as some of the people on the panel, and particularly the Department of Workforce Services, and that's obviously a fair criticism. Ian DeJong is involved in Salt Lake City's longer-term effort to direct services in a sort of smarter way through these new homeless shelters. But he's not involved in the planning stages of Operation Rio Grande. He may not have known previously exactly the problems that neighborhood was facing. And in particular, he may not have quite understood the nuances between the homeless population there and what they call the street-involved population there, where there were many people who were coming to the area, officials think, just to do drugs and sell drugs, and they actually had homes. They didn't need homeless services. And they think that those people are gone now. It makes it much, much easier to direct those services to the people that need them. And, if you look at 500 West and Rio Grande Street, certainly they look very different today than they did when this started.
Well, Robert Gerke, some criticism here of Operation Rio Grande from, an expert. is this project, Operation Rio Grande, being misunderstood?
I mean, this is going to sound like a cop-out, but I think everybody's right to some extent, right? I mean, as Matt mentioned, you did have a criminal element down there that needed to be controlled. And if you didn't control it, then those people who were truly homeless people are going to be victims of that criminal element. So I think so you arresting your way out of it is not a solution, but it's part of the solution. I think what is really the critical element to this now, at this point in the operation, is, as Ian mentioned, getting people help. This has been about social control, not social service. It needs to become about social service now, and getting the people help and getting the funding for the treatment that they need, and then getting them housing, which is sort of going to be an even more complicated issue, which is when Robert Marbot came to town, that was what he said is the big issue, is that Utah has a lack of affordable housing or transitional housing for these people. And so, frankly, the roundup, the raids, and the arrests—that's the easy part, right? Now we're getting to the nitty-gritty part of this, and part of that is going to depend on the state getting these Medicaid dollars that it needs, right. And that waiver is still in limbo right now. The state had hoped to have that money and have that program in effect by November 1st. The federal government is still not acting on that. We had everybody. We had the governor. We had the congressional leader or the state legislative leaders and the governor's health department director out there recently trying to lobby for this. And you kind of wonder, because the Trump has bragged about how he's sort of slow walked a similar program in Iowa, if this is being caught up in anti-Obamacare fervor.
Well, and I want to get to that with Matt Piper, because you did report on that story. But just quickly, I want to circle back to the Operation Rio Grande, dealing with the so-called criminal element. There's obviously overlap between people who have criminal histories and who are homeless. There's no, it's not like they're two separate groups, correct? Just to get that out of the way.
Correct, and there are some national watchdogs who are. Who are on the lookout for programs that appear to be criminalizing homelessness. And what they're particularly looking for are, crackdowns on loitering or camping or those sorts of things. But they say that cracking down on drug use can sort of venture into that territory as well, because some of these people are not in control of their actions. And if you book them into jail and you give them additional charges, you just create additional barriers to success for them. And so one thing, the leadership in Operation Rio Grande, it was cognizant of that, I think, from day one, and they looped in the ACLU, even though the ACLU was quick to clarify that they hadn't
advised
or you know, stamped the ACLU brand onto it. That they would have to provide these treatment beds, and the treatment beds at this stage are 1/4 in effect, with the other 3/4 waiting now on this this Medicaid waiver approval.
What does the fact that we're waiting on this Medicaid waiver? You reported actually on the fact that we had this state delegation go to Washington, meet with the cabinet member involved. This is Tom Price, who is head of Health and Human Services, and then. The visit ended in kind of a bizarre fashion. Maybe you can quickly tell us about that.
Yeah, it's the meeting that Robert was referring to last week, and it's kind of a quirky anecdote, I guess, that when they met with Secretary Price, he received a phone call from the White House, and he stepped out. And when he came back about 10 minutes later, Senator Todd Weiler says he was visibly sort of crestfallen. And after Governor Herbert and Speaker Hughes delivered the messages that they came to deliver, one of which was, we need this money for Operation Rio Grande. They were sort of ushered out by the chief of staff. And, before Senator Weiler could get on the plane the next day, Price had resigned. Mm-hmm. So whether or not you need a congressionally approved secretary to do something like this, I'm not sure that you do. I don't know what the precedent is there, but it certainly
right. Can someone else at Health and Human Services make that decision to grant the waiver?
I mean, they'd have the ability to. Yeah. I guess the question would be whether or not that's such a big decision that they would hold off.
You have a director of Medicaid services, and they have staff that reviews these things, and I think they can make the determination. So ideally, the secretary's departure isn't going to actually delay this much. But if I could go back to one thing, too. I mean, sure. I think part of the problem with Operation Rio Grande so far has been that the Pioneer Park Coalition, this group of business owners who have property down there, their motivation is they want the homeless people out of their neighborhood, and so that part in that way the law enforcement end of this has been really effective, and there's been motivation, there's been some momentum behind that element of it, and as I said, now we're getting to the hard part, which is getting those people treatment and getting them into housing, and it's the question that we have to wait and see, and I think this is what Ian was getting at in his criticism, is there going to be the same motivation, the same movers and shakers pushing that element of it? Because if you don't do that, you're not going to have a long-term solution to this homeless issue. And those business owners who wanted the homeless people out of their neighborhood are going to see them coming back in just a few months, because you can't just keep locking people up.
Well, if you can draw the line between their vested interest and the vested interest of the people who need homes.
Yeah.
How many beds are planned for treatment? When will they come online? Obviously this Medicaid waiver is gonna play a big hand in that. But what's the plan right now?
So they wanted 240 beds, which would have been pretty huge.
This is for treatment
for beds, right? For drug addiction residential treatment. That would have been. Or will be, if it comes to fruition, a really big addition to the current system. There's like a 6 to 9 month waiting list for the county's drug treatment beds. Last year, we saw about 60 come available through Operation Diversion, which was sort of a precursor to Operation Rio Grande, or maybe the inspiration for it in a way. So far through Operation Rio Grande, they brought on an additional 60 beds. And the next 180 are kind of contingent on this Medicaid waiver approval.
Okay.
At least at this stage, it's worth noting. I mean, the state could always
then the assumption being that when the Medicaid waiver comes in, they'll get reimbursed for that, for money they pay out of pocket. I'm not sure that the state has that money in its reserves right now, especially since they're trying to stretch some CHIP money and to keep the Children's Health Insurance Program going.
Are the people who are struggling with substance abuse disorder or mental health problems, are they at the moment receiving help? I mean, are there options for all of the people out there who are struggling that way?
There are many people waiting for residential drug treatment beds, but there are also additional resources. There are there's the Salt Lake City Police Department's Community Connection Center, where they have a team of social workers who work in the community to help connect people with what resources are available. And through Operation Rio Grande, there's been another team of about 10 social workers that have sort of amplified their efforts. And there's also, you know, it's worth noting, too, there are other jail treatment programs for people who are in the Salt Lake County Jail for a longer period. And so it's not just these 240 treatment beds that can help people, but those are the ones that are new as part of Operation Rio Grande.
Okay. And in the meantime, we'll wait and see what happens with this Medicaid waiver. Guys, we have just a little bit more time remaining in the show, and so I want to squeeze in one more story. And Matt Canham, I will return to you, Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham with Salt Lake Tribune. It's the latest revelation related to the tenure in office of Salt Lake County Recorder Gary Ott. What we've learned is that in 2013, there was a diagnosis that was given to him. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Gary Ott, the former Salt Lake County recorder, suffered from dementia, and it's now pretty severe Alzheimer's. But he was diagnosed with dementia. He was having memory problems a year before he started his reelection campaign in 2014, and it only obviously got worse since then. He had two aides that ran his campaign, shielded him from most public comments, and has obviously done the work of the recorder's office for the bulk of his tenure before his family was able to get control of the situation and resign on his behalf. This is in a hearing over his custody between his former fiance, Carmen Sinone, and his family. And the Salt Lake Tribune, among a group of other media organizations, intervened to have this hearing be open to the public. Our argument being that this is an elected official, and it's about his mental capacity in office. And while the hearing is about who has custody of him now, it has huge effects on how we think about public policy when it comes to elected officials who have a clear mental problem as they age. And it's a pretty sad case when you hear what he went through. You know, so many of us have family members who have been through something like this, and to do it on such a public stage is kind of sad.
Is there a sense, I mean, I guess in this hearing of who knew what when, like were his staff members aware of this diagnosis? And do we know that yet?
Maybe Carmen Sinone, who did work for the county and was his fiance and where he lived, attended many of these doctor's appointments with him. And while the doctor can't recall if the doctor sat down specifically with Carmen and spelled it out, he can't imagine, since she was in the room, that she didn't understand what his situation was. Many of his employees saw a mental decline where he had a hard time reading complex documents, and then he had a hard time in conversation. He just stopped showing up for work. It was pretty clear that there were problems.
You mentioned the custody hearing. Has that been decided? And then also, is the how about the request that the Tribune and other media organizations had? Have they been granted that ability to be there?
So we're there. It was granted yesterday morning, and it's a two-day hearing. So it concludes today. At least we think it will. Okay. These are long days. We heard yesterday from doctors. Julie Dole, who was his deputy and who ran for his seat within the party when he resigned, is expected to take to be before the judge today, and we'll see what she has to say about this.
Okay, Robert.
And if I could, I mean, I think Carmen and Julie have a lot to answer for in this situation, because they really engaged in some pretty deplorable, despicable behavior, and I think there should be a criminal investigation into whether they're. Took advantage of a vulnerable adult, you know, and if nothing else, they were lying to voters, trying to cover up his infirmity, and it's just really disgraceful behavior on their part.
Well, we'll have to see what happens, or if that happens. And for the moment, we're going to have to leave that story there, because the time has come for us to turn to our final segment of the show, Underplayed Stories of the Week. And maybe I'll go to Matt Piper to start with. Matt, you want to take the lead?
Yeah, sure. Aaron Falk followed up on what was a sort of viral sensation over the weekend. BYU's dance team at the moment is far outstripping their football team in terms of success, and they brought the Cosmo the Cougar in on it. There was a halftime routine where this anonymous senior at BYU apparently has no formal dance training. Gave what was described in a text message to one of the BYU dancers as a lit performance. And if you haven't seen it yet, I encourage you to check it out.
Check it out. Worth watching. Matt Canham, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
So Negro Bill Canyon in Grand County has been renamed by a federal board to Grand Staff Canyon, which is the last name of a African-American who lived in the area and got ran out of town for allegedly selling whiskey to the Indians. Yeah. So that was an interesting debate because we had civil rights groups in Utah who were on both sides of this, saying that the history of calling it Negro Bill Canyon was worth preserving, and others saying we can honor the man by calling him by his name, not by a moniker that people gave that was racially insensitive.
Okay. Yeah, interesting story. Check it out at sltrip.com. And Robert Gerke, your pick for
him. I'm going to kind of stay in the same vein as my friend Whitey Matt here. And the good folks up in Wellsville decided this week that they're going to do away with the tradition of having people dress as Indians for their annual sham battle that they do every Labor Day. This is something that had gone on for decades, generations, and I kind of maybe drew a little bit of attention to it. And so they're going to be working with the Northwest Band, the Shoshone Band, up there to try to kind of come up with something, a celebration that is more culturally sensitive, reflects all of the different aspects of the settlement of the Cache Valley, and does it in a way that's not demeaning and derogatory and culturally insensitive. And so, you know, it took a while to get there, but I think they've come to a good place, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they come up with for the next Founders Day.
And they said people won't dress up, I mean, as Native Americans anymore. And this is something that you did draw attention to with a column that you wrote. For my part, all of this heavy news, I think I'm going to go with low-hanging fruit here. Not underplayed in my family at all. The Chicago Cubs are advancing to the National League Championship Series after beating the Nationals last night in a sometimes bizarre and definitely hard-fought nail-biter of a game. Onto the pennant for the Cubs, I'm excited for. After years of drought.
Fly the W.
Fly the W. Exactly. Matt Canham, Robert Gerke, Matt Piper, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks. Have a good weekend.
You.
Have a good weekend. That's it for this edition of the show. Thanks to KCPW's Jesse Ellis. In Logan, the broadcast is managed by Tom Williams, Spencer Holsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen. Thanks, as always, to the show's producer, Emily Means. We spent a good deal of today talking about homelessness. You can hear the voices of people experiencing homelessness themselves on Emily's show, In the Hive. You can find it in podcast form as well as podcasts of all of our local shows, including this one, at kcpw.org. And while you're there, we are still a little shy of our fall fundraising goal, so please consider making a pledge of support. I'm Roger McDonough, and you've been listening to Behind the Headlines. Have a wonderful day and a great weekend.
There are 14,932 ways to fall on the radio. In this next hour of Radiolab, we will bring you 8. Falling! That's the next Radiolab.
Join us tomorrow at noon on Utah Public Radio.
Listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.